This podcast of To The Point is a production of KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com. Support for KCRW podcasts comes from the Southern California Lexus dealers.
From PRI, Public Radio International, and KCRW Santa Monica, this is To The Point.
Is presidential power reaching an unchecked status? I'm Diana Nyad, sitting in for Warren Olney, and this is To The Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. Today on the show, as more details emerge regarding President Bush's order to eavesdrop without warrant on overseas telephone calls and emails of U.S. citizens with suspected ties to terrorism, the level of current presidential power is under scrutiny. There are members of Congress who claim something must be done to put the executive branch back in check. Bush retorts that we are at war, and a new kind of war, for which the intelligence measures in question are fair game. On Reporter's Notebook later on, a new biography about the life of the intriguing film director, Alia Kazan. First, here's the news.
Support for To The Point comes from subscribers of KCRW Santa Monica and from the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
I'm Diana Nyad, sitting in for Warren Olney, back with To The Point from PRI. Our main topic today, some members of both the House and Senate are complaining that their legislative duties in terms of keeping the executive branch and presidential power in check have been hamstrung. Critics of the Bush administration go so far as to call today's Congress invisible. Bush responds that the urgency of 9/11 precipitated change in our intelligence gathering tactics. The administration argues that it needs the freedom to make quick decisions in navigating this new anti-terrorism landscape and defends the decision to eavesdrop on some Americans' phone calls and emails when connections to terrorists are suspected. On Reporter's Notebook a bit later, a new revealing biography of the controversial film director Alia Kazan is out. Warren Olney talks to the biographer, Time magazine film critic Richard Schickel. First, this news today. A lull in Iraq's daily street violence followed national elections 12 days ago. But car bombs and rocket-propelled grenades are once again erupting. Also today, over 10,000 people peacefully marched through the streets of Baghdad, calling for national unity and a government representing equally Sunnis and Shiites. Well, for an update from Iraq, we welcome Borzu Daragahi, who's a Los Angeles Times staff writer in the Baghdad Bureau. Mr. Daragahi, thank you, first of all, for all your time today.
It's a pleasure.
Let's first of all talk about this peaceful march, about 10,000 people, because the way I read it, in the elections 10 days ago, considering that the Sunni Arabs represent about 20% of the country's general population, and about 20% of the candidates from the Sunni Arabs won position, so that would seem mathematically to be a fair representation. What is the beef, shall we say?
Well, I think that from the very beginning of this, since the toppling of Saddam, Sunni Arabs have basically refused to accept that they're a minority, despite any of the demographic data that's been presented to them, despite, you know, election after election. They just don't accept it. I think maybe it's akin to, maybe Serbian refusal to accept the sort of relations they had with the rest of the Yugoslavs. They just refused to accept that. And I think also that the secular Iraqis and the nationalists, they also thought they were absolutely convinced that they would do better because they know Iraq, and everyone they know and everyone they talk to said that they were going to vote for, you know, secular liberal candidates. So how is it that all of the religious parties and the ethnic parties won? And I think that, again, is just a function of their being completely sort of disconnected from the mainstream of Iraqi life, which is very rural or very recently urbanized, not very well educated, and extremely pious.
And when you describe it that way, there's obviously a huge emotionality behind it. But with the demographics, as we say, you know, quite fair and representative now with this new parliament coming into place, you know, do they have grounds to stand on? Will there be, you know, members of the other faction, the Shiites, who find any reason to back down and make changes?
Well, absolutely. I think the Shiites and the Kurds are, for one thing, under U.S. pressure to accommodate the Sunnis, as well as some of the more less sort of the secular nationalists that aren't tied so strongly to Saddam Hussein's regime. So they want to do that. And the Americans are very much pushing for that. It's a formula for stabilizing the country. So yeah, I think that'll happen. I think that they will be given a role at the bargaining table. And it's already started to some extent. I was talking to some Shiite leader just a couple days ago, and he was saying, yeah, you know, these guys who are out there on the street every day yelling and screaming are the same ones who are, you know, calling us up in the evening saying, hey, let's make a deal.
And what about the complaint, which seems to be quite valid on the Sunni Arabs' part, that they may not be part of the decision-making legislative process much yet, but they certainly are not much part of the military and police force?
Yeah, I think that's a very interesting thing, and it's something that the U.S. military planners have been struggling with, is trying to get Iraqi Sunni Arabs into the armed forces. And, you know, some of the complaints that they've made is that, you know, we try to get them, we integrate, we create these, you know, sort of ethnically and, you know, religiously balanced units, and then the Sunnis drop out. And the extent of those, you know, sort of that imbalance became clear when the special voting was released, the numbers for the special voting, which were like the people who were voting before the elections because they had to work security details during the election.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just so lopsided in the direction of Shiites and Kurds. And against the Sunnis, that it just became very blatantly obvious for the first time just how lopsided the security forces are.
We only have a minute left, but if you would, Mr. Daragahi, address the uncovering of the mass grave today down in Karbala. Hundreds and hundreds of bodies found of Shiites, I understand.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, we have a correspondent in Najaf, and he covers Karbala, and he, you know, sent us some information about that. And essentially, you had some sanitation or some urban municipal workers. They were digging up a public park, and they found a grave with at least 20 bodies, some of them women and children. And, you know, they're fairly convinced, and they probably will be able to prove this once there's some forensic testing, that these were Iraqi Shiites that were killed in the 1991 uprising against Saddam Hussein.
Mr. Daragahi,
you know,
please accept my apologies, but thank you very much. Informative report from Baghdad. Be safe yourself. Borzu Daragahi from the L.A. Times in Baghdad. Be back in just a moment with more of To the Point.
To the Point thanks Factiva, a Dow Jones and Reuters company, for its use of Factiva.com. With news and information from 8,000 global sources, Factiva is a resource for companies whose continued success rests upon timely strategic news on their industry, competitors, and themselves.
I'm Diana Nyad, back with To the Point. Warren Olney's on vacation this week. Further details of a domestic spying program are surfacing day by day. Post 9/11, under the auspices of the National Security Agency, President Bush authorized eavesdropping, without a warrant, of overseas calls and emails of U.S. citizens. The spy operation, as well as the cases of abusing prisoners of war and a dozen or so other current issues, have all brought presidential power into question. The administration stands is that in times of war, the Constitution vests in the president unrestricted executive power. Yet politicians are at the moment in an uproar over the domestic spying program and are pushing to return to a system whereby the legislative branch wields enough power to keep the executive branch in check. A few even go so far as to suggest Bush undergo impeachment proceedings. Well, our first guest today is John Dean, writer and lecturer based in Los Angeles, of course, former counsel to President Nixon, and author of many books at this point, including Worse Than Watergate, The Secret Presidency of George W. Bush. Mr. Dean, thank you very much for offering your observations today with us.
Pleasure to join you.
Okay. Let's start, first of all, President Bush and the administration as of 10 days ago making statements about the domestic spying incident here as simply to and only to intercept communications of people with known links to al-Qaeda and related terrorist organizations. And of course, as I said, now, day by day, exponentially, we're finding that the volume of information gathered in this spying operation is much larger than that. Where does it stand at this point, and how important is it that we know just how big the volume is?
Well, I don't think anybody would quibble with the objective the president has, which is to prevent a terrorist attack on the United States.
Yes.
I think that the whole question revolves around what are the means he's employing to do so. And the volume question comes up in my mind because the number of Americans who may well be subject to what could be considered an unreasonable search. They just accidentally get picked up in a wiretap that is really directed to a good cause, but is also sweeping people in for doing nothing. And that's where, when you get into big volumes and you start getting into data mining, is what we apparently are doing, that the innocent get sucked in and no protection is really being provided.
But the way I understand it in this volume data mining, as the phrase goes, is it's not so much a matter of intercepting the actual content of the emails and the phone calls and that sort of invasion of privacy. It's really a big picture sort of macro data look. How many phone calls made to particular possible connection to Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan repetitively over this time? Now, what's the harm in that?
Well, you know, it's a good question. We're really short on facts on this. If you go back to the original story that James Risen broke and reporting on all this, he said that there were ongoing wiretaps of roughly about 500 Americans at any given time in the United States. And this didn't really report the mining at that point. And apparently they're using the mining to pick up who they want to be listening to. But as I say, we don't have all the facts on this, so we don't know. But it was my understanding, based on the original story, that there is ongoing surveillance going of at least 500 Americans at any given time.
And what is your response? I mean, you know, the law is your area of expertise, and President Bush cites Article 2 of the Constitution saying that it is absolutely necessary in these unusual times to intercept any possible communication between terrorist organizations.
Well, this has been litigated and looked at for a long time, and there really is no definitive answer as to how far Article 2 powers go. There has been some fairly definitive categorization of where his powers are strong and where they're weak under an opinion written by Justice Jackson when Truman tried to seize the steel mills during the Korean police action.
Mm-hmm.
And the court got into it and defined what the president's powers were. And where the president does not have congressional authority, he's at his weakest point. That appears to be the case here, although the administration is taking a very, very aggressive stretch on its authorization to be engaged in fighting terrorism, as also authorizing this wiretapping. So it's pretty fuzzy, and it's not the sort of thing that's likely to ever end up in front of the Supreme Court, so it's really going to be a political decision.
And when you bring that up, let's talk about a political decision. The term "invisible Congress" has been bandied about over the last week or so. There are so many members of Congress right now who just absolutely feel that their voices mean nothing, and they can do nothing to use their legislative power to put some kind of check on the executive power.
Well, this Congress has really not shown much interest in exercising its institutional powers or even holding up institutional pride. Oversight isn't something that's been very important on the agenda and doesn't look like it's going to continue to be. In fact, some members of Congress who were alerted to this surveillance really didn't want to hear about it. Some of the people at NSA were upset about it, concerned about it, thought they were breaking the law in doing it, and went to members of Congress to talk about it, and we're given a cold shoulder that we don't want to hear about it. I think we do have an invisible Congress.
You know, it's another legal question I had for you is, you know, if members of the National Security Association were already, let's say, if feeling some pangs of guilt or, you know, needed to expose what they were doing publicly, what about the executives of the telecommunications industry, who, you know, just willy-nilly gave permission to do all this wiretapping? Weren't there some concern of those lawyers there as to whether this was just or not?
One would think so. This is apparently the issue of whether they opened up their switching operations through which masses of information and data flow and just made those available for data mining. We don't have, again, many facts on this, but one would think that some general counsel somewhere in one of those organizations would be thinking about the potential of a conspiracy to violate the wiretap law.
Yeah. You know, I have read over recent days your exact quote saying that you believe this NSA executive order by President Bush is an impeachable offense. Still feel that way?
Well, I do. When I first heard it, I was surprised. It was one of the, it was after I heard the broadcast of the president explaining how he was his justification, and to me, it was the first time I'd ever heard a president willingly confess to an impeachable offense. Richard Nixon was impeached in Article 2 of his Bill of Impeachment, which never got a vote in the House, but the House Judiciary Committee, on some 8 wiretaps that he believed were justified by national security. The Congress said they were not, and they put them in the Bill of Impeachment. They were actually trying to track down leaks. He wiretapped 5 members of the NSA, and then 2 newsmen and 1 Defense Department official, trying to track down what he found a serious problem in trying to govern when his decisions were ending up on the front page of the newspapers.
Well, Barbara Boxer now has, on her own, sent out a letter to legal scholars asking their opinions, specifically on the impeachment matter. I think it's a good time for us to bring in an expert on that area of the law, David Rifkin, lawyer in Washington, as I say, expert in national security law. He served in the Department of Justice and the White House in the Reagan and the George H.W. Bush administrations. Mr. Rifkin, thank you for being here.
Pleasure to be with you.
But let's start right out with impeachment.
Since I personally don't think that the president has violated the law or the Constitution in any way or even gotten close to the line, I think the discussion of impeachment is frankly ludicrous and just reflects sort of more of a partisanship of the critics involved than anything else. There are many difficult issues of law and policy involved in this war, but this is not one of them.
And when you say that it hasn't even come close, there are certainly a number of members of Congress jumping up and down in an uproar saying he's not just come close, he's stepped over the line. So isn't it a bit fuzzy? How can any of you be that
well,
far away from it?
Yeah, I kind of like to debate this in the merits instead of looking at how many politicians are jumping up and down about it. And
okay, fair enough.
You're right. The Republicans as well as Democrats are jumping up and down. But that to me reflects more a very unfortunate tendency to denigrate presidential powers. The time in our history where a robust and vigorous executive power is all more essential. But well, let's talk about the substance, if we can.
Okay. Let's bring up the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. Okay, instituted in 1952, you know, there are powers by which a president could commandeer the surveillance that President Bush has now with the NSA. But you must go get a warrant. Detail that for us. Is it a 72-hour period?
Well, let's back up a little bit and say this. Congress came up with a regulatory scheme, which everybody is talking about, and that's Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act that was actually enacted in 1978. Every single administration since the 1978 statute was enacted, which is Carter, Reagan, Bush 41, and Clinton, have asserted that despite the statute, and I emphasize the word despite the statute, the president retains inherent plenary constitutional power to order warrantless surveillance, and have done that. Meaning they've used warrantless surveillance despite the existence of FISA, essentially during the peacetime. And the view that the president has inherent power to order warrantless surveillance, and the only issue is how that intelligence take, if you will, can be used, whether it can be used in criminal prosecution purposes, probably not, has been addressed by a number of courts. Every single court, including the Supreme Court, who's looked at that, has affirmed the president has inherent constitutional power to order warrantless surveillance. Most recently, on June 18, 2002, the FISA very own court, the appellate chamber of that court, and the only opinion it ever issued, specifically said the president has this power. So to me, the only have a piece in today's New York Times that actually gets into it. The only thing it's outrageous about is the outrage. It's absurd. It's like everybody suddenly developed amnesia all of a sudden.
But I think the point here is that it's not just specifically the spying issue, and it's not just specifically the time of war, isn't it? Haven't many other issues, non-war issues, come up during this administration?
But forgive me. I mean, it may be useful to have a broad discussion, but I kind of like to have a narrow discussion. I don't want to talk about detainees. I don't want to talk about interrogation techniques and all this other stuff. We're talking about this particular issue. This particular issue being a very narrow use of presidential power, by the way, more narrow as a matter of prudence, but as a matter of constitutional law. The president basically said since September 11 that he's going to, without going to the FISA court, authorize warrantless surveillance to be reviewed every 45 days of conversations where at least one party is overseas and one party is known or believed to be an al-Qaeda member. This is nothing more than giving intelligence, not foreign intelligence, military intelligence, about the enemy that's attacked us on September 11. I mean, if a president cannot do that, then the commander-in-chief power means nothing. Because how are you supposed to use force if you cannot give information about plans and intent? To emphasize for benefit of your listeners, this is not a generic power to give a foreign intelligence or intelligence about terrorism. This is a power to give a battlefield intelligence.
You know, understood. And John Dean, if you'd come back with us for a moment, when you hear David Rifkin, you know, emphatically state this, it's a very narrow use of executive power. And you think of the changing times. As President Bush has said many times, we're not talking about days of action. We're talking about moments, literally an hour, a few minutes of interpreting some sort of intelligence in terms of terrorists. Then. We stand on the other side of the fence in terms of your original impeachment.
Well, if you go back to, again, we're talking means, not ends, the president has had several years now in which he could get this problem corrected with congressional approval and has chosen not to. Rather, he has indeed insisted on going and sort of an in-your-face, I'm going to do it my way approach, and not even trusted the Congress to deal with this issue. The procedures that David mentioned being put in place came long after the fact. In fact, they didn't come until 2004 when people were worried that if indeed John Kerry might get elected, he might start a criminal investigation and there are no procedures or protections at all. When it was first implemented, there was absolutely no protection whatsoever. There was none of this 45-day review. There was none of this decision anybody outside of NSA deciding who the targets would be. So it changed and evolved and has not been quite as David characterizes it.
Would David Rifkin come back, would you? Because, you know, it is a question. There has been such congressional approval for all kinds of wiretapping without judicial warrants since the Patriot Act of 2001. Why not go to Congress again this time?
Well, a couple of things. The reason you do not want to use the FISA statute is because the entire regulatory scheme does not fit this particular set of circumstances, and I would argue was not written for that purpose. We can elaborate on that a little bit. Now, the broader question which Mr. Dean is raising, why not go to Congress for a different framework? It is a fair question. It is a reasonable question.
Mm-hmm.
I would submit to you that it may have been desirable to do that, but that's a policy question. We first have to take off the table this sort of a classical Washington bugaboo, laws were broken, this is an impeachable offense. If a president indeed would have been well advised to go to Congress early on and have a serious debate about this and have Congress provide for statutory authorization for something that I personally strongly believe,
Mr.
every
Rifkin,
administration believes.
Would you allow me to be so rude? We have to take a break right at this moment.
Sure.
Have to do it. Be right back.
Transcripts of To the Point are available from the Transcription Company, 818-848-6500, or on the web at transcripts.net. A CD copy of To the Point is available by calling 1-800-600-5279.
I'm Diana Nyad, sitting in for Warren Olney today on To the Point. We're discussing the issue of presidential power in the Bush administration and whether Congress has virtually lost its role in keeping that power in check, but more specifically, the particular domestic spying issue that's in the front pages at the moment. Speaking with David Rifkin, lawyer in Washington, expert in national security law, and I apologize for interrupting you, Mr. Rifkin, but continue as to why the administration didn't go to Congress for approval in this particular spy operation.
Yeah, I mean, this is a matter over which reasonable people can disagree. I happen to think the administration, absolutely any administration, has plenary power in time of war. and we could disagree about the scope of this power in principle, but at least the power is broad enough to encompass being able to derive battlefield/military intelligence. If the administration came to Congress and said, we already have plenary power, but would feel better having another political branch join us, may have been reasonable. I'm not sure even in a post-September environment they would have gotten it. If you look at the unfortunate spectacle of a Patriot Act, moreover, it's not clear that Congress would have reauthorized it, and the critics, frankly, would have said, see, there's a price you pay, constitutionally speaking, because every time you look at a serious separation of powers issue, the question is not just what the Constitution says, but what's the executive practice. So every time the executive goes to Congress and asks for, in essence, a confirming legislation, if the legislation is not forthcoming or forthcoming with some caveats, you sort of weaken the executive power. But we can have a serious discussion about the policy as long as we get this, you know, canard off a table that the president is somehow violating the Constitution.
John Dean's with us today, too. Of course, the former counsel to President Nixon, writer, lecturer based here in Los Angeles. Mr. Dean, it occurs to me on the public's end, too, that, you know, change is coming awfully quickly to all of our lives every day. And post 9/11, given that we are a culture so passionate about our civil liberties, reading about the surveillance, it takes on an emotional reaction to a lot of people, doesn't it?
Well, it does indeed. It's very interesting. Different types of personalities have different reactions to whether or not they're troubled. A lot of authoritarian figures don't really have much trouble at all because they always perceive it's going to be somebody else who's going to be under surveillance. People who are less authoritarian realize it could indeed affect them and everyone else, and we're on a slippery slope. So different points for different folks.
Let's bring in Professor Harvey Mansfield now. He's the author of Taming the Prince, The Ambivalence of Modern Executive Power, a professor of government at Harvard University. Professor Mansfield, thank you very much for joining the conversation.
It's a pleasure.
Well, let's talk about a little bit broader terms here, and whether when an entirely Republican Congress comes up against an executive party Republican as well, do we really have the checks and balances that we have had in previous administrations?
I think we have them, if perhaps in diminished force. I would say that I mean, we've heard two sides now.
Mm-hmm.
This is a typical argument in United States political or constitutional history between the rule of law, which is the argument that supports Congress, because Congress makes laws, and executive discretion, which is the argument that the president always uses. At the time of Clinton's impeachment a few years ago, it was the Republicans in Congress who were upholding the rule of law, and the Democrats who were saying, this is a small matter and don't be so censorious. So I think that each party uses the argument that's available to it according to whether it holds the presidency or the Congress. But both those arguments are in a way true. I mean, a free country is one that has a rule of law, which means standing rules that everybody knows about beforehand. But the trouble is that a rule of law doesn't always account for emergencies that may arise. And so when an emergency arises, you need to have some provision for wise discretion by some authority in the government, and that's the executive. But then the problem with wise discretion is the danger of unwise discretion. So, and therefore you go back to the rule of law. So I think there's a kind of circle or alternation here, and our Constitution, I think, very intelligently contains both possibilities and both arguments, and it's a matter of judgment, really, which is the which of the two ought to prevail in any current situation.
But I wonder if you could analyze for us this one statistic that struck out in me in preparing for today's show. Back in the mid-1990s, the Republican-controlled House of Representatives aggressively delved into all kinds of alleged misconduct by the Clinton administration. There were 140 hours logged, sworn testimony on the basically the Christmas card list that President Clinton supposedly had used to identify potential Democratic donors, all right? In the past 2 years, a House committee has managed to take only 12 hours of sworn testimony about the abuse of prisoners at Iraq's Abu Ghraib prison. And there are many, 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 statistics cited in this way to compare these two administrations, just to say it seems that if anyone sneezed during that former time, there was a full-fledged investigation going on. And now it's not just time of crisis. I think all of us can understand at a very moment of crisis, let's act quickly, let's go to total executive power. But it's within the whole timber of this administration. Some people suggest that the democratic process is being whittled away a bit.
No, I wouldn't say that.
Really?
What you point to merely reflects the fact that a Republican Congress prefers a Republican president to a Democratic president, and so it criticizes the Republican president less. And that isn't necessarily true, because some Republicans might be disaffected, but I think most of them are generally satisfied with the Bush administration, its decision to go into Iraq, and for the most part, its administration of the war, which now looks better and better. So, I wouldn't be worried by that contrast so much. It might be an argument for divided government, that you should always have Congress and presidency and the presidency in the hands of different parties. And I also don't think that that Congress should keep the executive branch in check, in the sense of being able to stop it. It's one thing to criticize and to hold it to account, but it's another thing to stop it from acting. I don't think we want a power in our Constitution that prevents government from acting when it may be necessary.
So that the executive branch should always be accountable.
It will be accountable, but after the fact and not before. I think our free government needs to be able to do anything that any government wants to do. And so even though it has to be devoted to the rule of law, it also has to admit that there are exceptions which arise. And this so-called spying, or you might call it military intelligence, might seem to be a useful example of that.
You know, can I bring John Dean back in a moment to respond to something you said about the statistics that I threw out? There's another one here, Mr. Dean. Democrats on the current committee saying a panel issued 1,052 subpoenas to probe alleged misconduct during the Clinton administration. Cost about $35 million, by the way. There have been three subpoenas of investigation during the Bush administration, two to the Energy Department over nuclear waste disposal, and one just recently to the Defense Department over the Katrina documents. Is this truly just an indication of where the political power lies today? Go ahead.
I think Professor Mansfield is correct in describing it being a Republican administration not terribly anxious to hold to account a Republican president. Some others might define it as hypocrisy.
Mm-hmm.
So it's one's point of view. I actually not a partisan in all this. I have been described in this conversation as being on the other party. I'm really not. I don't really carry water for anybody. I'm just taking a point of view, if you will. And however you want to look at it, pure hypocrisy that they won't hold this president accountable. I happen to start in government on Capitol Hill as a committee counsel when the Democrats controlled both ends of Pennsylvania Avenue. And I actually, in those days, back in the 60s, saw the Democratic Congress hold the Democratic presidency of Lyndon Johnson responsible for things and conduct oversight. It hasn't been true since the Republicans have taken control of the Congress, however.
I'd be interested in getting into the historical perspective of executive power, especially in times of war. And for that, we turn to Professor Richard Cohn, who's professor of history and chairman of the curriculum in peace, war, and defense at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, currently studying presidential war leadership. Professor Cohn, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Let's run through a little bit of history, and I'll throw it out right at the beginning. Does history really matter? If we go back to Abe Lincoln at the during the Civil War, does it really have any context for today's terrorism war?
Well, I think it does, because although Mr. Rifkin would like to consider this in the most narrow aspects of a legal problem, I think the public and the Congress are trying to consider this in a larger historical context. First, you have to ask whether the dangers facing the United States today are as great or as pressing, rather, is there as great an emergency as during the Civil War or World War II or during the Cold War? And then second of all, people want to try to judge the Bush administration and the behavior of this president and the assertions of executive power by this president against a historical background to see if they're at all legitimate or persuasive.
And?
Well, my own judgment is that presidents have gone beyond the war or beyond the law when they thought it was necessary. Certainly Mr. Lincoln did in his suspension of habeas corpus and his creation of military commissions and his imprisoning of people. President Roosevelt did occasionally too, asserting by executive order, for example, the incarceration of Japanese Americans. President Truman and the seizure of the steel industry. But the difference that I see is that the Bush administration has propounded an almost unlimited, in fact, it's not almost, it is an unlimited assertion of executive power in wartime, and has not seemed to be at all comfortable with any oversight of that, even by the Supreme Court. Its assertions have been all-encompassing. It's been a suspension, although not formal, of habeas corpus in the cases of Mr. Hamdi and Mr. Padilla, and other attempts to manipulate the legal system to have almost unlimited power.
Well, hold on. I want to bring David Rifkin back in to respond mm-hmm. to that, lawyer in Washington. He's an expert in national security law. What's your response to that big statement there?
Well, it's a big statement, and if we had an hour, I would try to to put forward arguments as to why the habeas corpus was not suspended, and I haven't missed the Hamdi, missed the Padilla case, the proof being the pudding that their each habeas petition was heard by the courts. But let me just very briefly pick up on one point, an excellent point made by Professor Mansfield, whose book I'm a great fan of. Look, the very nature of executive power is that it does not lend itself well to congressional regulation, not because of even the constitutional framework, because of its very nature. The problem with trying to come up with a new FISA-type statute is precisely because in the business of gathering military intelligence, it's very difficult to come up with non-discretionary standards. It's not a matter of probable cause. You can have an American, for example, hypothetically speaking, who's entirely innocent, who's not an agent of Al-Qaeda, happens to know from some time in the past a person who's become a member of Al-Qaeda, who may be calling this person purely to let off steam. So neither the FISA court nor any other court would approve a warrant based on any culpability or any probable cause by this person. But ask yourself this question: is it not useful to get a little bit of a window at the actions and activities of our enemies? In that situation, it is purely in discretionary exercise of presidential power. Ask yourself this: how would Congress partake, or even the courts, in that discretionary exercise? And again, I think Professor Mansfield probably is the best person to confirm that some things inherently belong to the executive, and he's accountable if he abuses his power in a political sense, but not accountable in a sense that you're going to impeach him or you're going to have another statute. The very nature of the problem defies the kind of a typical congressional regulatory framework. It's important for people to understand that.
All right. Let me bring Professor Cohen back in, because, and I apologize, Professor Cohen, you've got so much to say and we have such little time, but wrap it up for us as quickly as you could. It's normal in times of war for a president and executive power to expand their powers and act without Congress, no?
Yes, it is, and it's certainly true that the framers of the Constitution understood that. But they also understood that there had to be some limits in wartime, even in wartime. And it's an age-old problem of trying to balance liberty with security, even during wartime. The problem with what I think the present Bush administration has done is it hasn't credibly demonstrated that the FISA laws – provide limits or limitations that can't be dealt with. It hasn't really asserted the nature of the emergency or the danger outside its own broad statements. If it, for example, had pursued, and I know this is a larger context, with such great emergency determination, the proliferation of nuclear weapons, say, to Iran and North Korea, or if it had pursued with the same degree of anxiousness, homeland security, some of these assertions of presidential power might be more credible.
Thank you. Professor Cohen, you will just have to lay down and give you my apology today. You've got so much to say, but we've got to go. I thank you so much for your time, Professor Mansfield as well, David Rifkin, and John Dean. On a reporter's notebook in just a minute, on the heels of today's debate about domestic spying, it's logical to reflect back to the times when the threat of communism was the focus of our national security. It was the 1950s, the so-called House Committee on Un-American Activities, or HUAC, investigated HUAC, Hollywood, on suspicion that the movies were being used to inject communist ideas into American culture. Among the witnesses was Alia Kazan, one of the greatest directors in film history. And in just a moment, Warren Olney talks to a recent biographer. That's on To the Point.
You can find more information on the program, including archived editions, at www.moretothepoint.com. More to the Point, all one word, .com.
This is Werman Olney with Reporter's Notebook on To the Point. In 1999, Alia Kazan was given an honorary Oscar at the age of 89, but not without a chorus of protest over what critics called his betrayal of friends that he named as former members of the Communist Party. In his new book, Alia Kazan, A Biography, Richard Schickel re-examines that episode, and he appraises Kazan's contribution to American culture, not just in films, but also in plays as well. Richard Schickel, welcome to our program.
Nice to be here.
How did you reassess that era? Seems it's a lot more complicated than a lot of people think that it was.
Well, you know, ideology makes morons of us all. I mean, you know, people tend to see that thing in very black and white terms. But of course, like all of life, there was a lot of gray area, which has to do in part with, you know, the disaffection of people like Kazan from their former Stalinist ideology and their disappointment, dismay, and anger at the party. That went into the testimony of a great many people who've testified as friendly witnesses in front of HUAC. I mean, I have no regard for HUAC, and I don't want to be thought of as a right-wing crazy. I mean, I just think, you know, it was a wretched institution. And people in that time, and people keep saying this, they say, I don't know what I would have done had I been in the situation of Kazan or the other 220-odd people who testified as friendly witnesses from show business in front of HUAC. And I don't know that either. So it's an attempt, I think, primarily to humanize the response of Kazan and others faced with this very difficult choice that they had to make.
And rightly or wrongly, it has done a lot to get in the way of a sober appraisal of his contribution to American culture.
Oh, I think so.
Which is a very extraordinary one.
It's the one. There are two things people know about Kazan. One is that he testified, and the other is that he directed On the Waterfront, which, of course, remains a, you know, one of the great American movies, certainly one, maybe the greatest American movie of the 1950s. So those are the two things people know. What people have forgotten is the length and distinction of his directorial career. I mean, he actually debuted Arthur Miller's Death of a Salesman on Broadway. He was Tennessee Williams' favorite director. He made at least a half dozen other movies that were, you know, extraordinarily good movies, movies that we can resort to with great pleasure and profit these days.
And to help to begin the careers of some very well-known actors who are still working today.
That's the other thing, you know. I mean, he was at the forefront of, the movement was kind of born back in the 1920s and 30s of Stanislavski and acting in this country. And the group theater, which was a leftist theater of great prominence in the 30s, was a place that nurtured that kind of realistic, I guess is the simple word to use, realistic acting on screen and stage.
Who were some of the people who came out of that?
Oh, lots of people. I mean, you know, Carl Malden, you know, Marlon Brando. Well, Marlon Brando wasn't a group theater guy, but...
But he was certainly one of the people
at
Kazan.
He was an inheritor of the group tradition,
sure.
You know. So was, in his way, I suppose, Jimmy Dean. You know, but the point is that it was a nest of people who went on to become, you know, rather good and rather prominent character actors in the theater. And then when Kazan's career as a director began to flourish, I mean, then we're getting, you know, just lots and lots of fabulous actors, you know, Lee Remick and, you know, even John Garfield to a degree, you know, coming out of the group tradition and, you know, establishing themselves as major players in the Hollywood scene. So I would say his work as a director was crucial in putting over this new manner of acting. You can almost say, you know, up to about 1950, you know, there was a lot of good acting in movies, but it was catch-as-catch-can. I mean, these were not, generally speaking, trained actors. And I think the idea, and of course, Kazan was the founder, people kind of forget this too, of the Actors Studio, mm-hmm. which was, you know, the place to learn how to act in a professional way in theater and film. And, you know, Lee Strasberg was, of course, famously there, although he and Kazan were not particularly close as intellectually, at least. It was a place that trained a generation, or now generations of actors, to do a certain kind of acting that was particularly good in movies, you know, with their air of realism. I would say that, you know, no matter how bad a movie that we go to today, you don't see the kind of bad standing around, saying lines, not exactly being in touch with your emotions that you routinely saw in American movies of the 30s and 40s.
So,
it's a different manner of acting.
Kazan then really helped to make an extraordinarily important change in the movies that we see today. You knew him.
Yeah.
Tell us a bit about him, what he was like.
Oh, I really loved Aaliyah. I began my association with him by doing a television documentary in this ongoing series I do of directors talking about their own work, and I came to know him then. That was in the early 90s, and I liked him. He was an unpretentious man. I mean, that was the salient quality about him. He knew what he was doing. He was proud of what he'd done, but he didn't take on a lot of airs about it. You know, he was really just a good guy. You feel a fellow like kind of kicking back and having a couple beers with him and just talking about anything that was on your mind.
Wasn't he also arrogant?
No, I never thought so. Mm-hmm. He was insinuating. That was his trick as a director. I mean, unlike a lot of directors, he really tried to get to know his actors. And, you know, he said to me, he said, the way to work with an actor is, you know, you go out, you have dinner with him, you meet his wife or his girlfriend or whatever, and you kind of learn about him. And then he would almost use that kind of personal knowledge of the actor as a kind of jujitsu to kind of, you know, often enough trick him into doing what Kazan wanted him to do on the stage or screen. But it was benign trickery. I mean, a lot of actors like Eli Wallach just laughed about it subsequently, you know, I mean, because he would really work that company in a highly personal way in order to get what he needed. So that was a fun part about Aaliyah.
Let me ask you this. He wrote a very highly regarded autobiography in 1998 called A Life. Why did you decide to write a biography about him, and why do it now?
Well, I'll tell you, I got sort of involved in that 99 Oscar thing. You know, I did the little film clip package that was on the broadcast, and I got myself involved in the controversy over Aaliyah. And I just sort of felt at the end of that, you know, that I wanted to write about Kazan, that I thought there was stuff left unsaid. And some of the things we've been talking about are things that are not said with fullness and clarity in his autobiography. Autobiographies are, ideally, you know, one man's slant on his own life. But the biographer can bring a lot of other stuff to the party. For example, you know, I do spend a good deal of time talking about Stalinist attitudes and all that and how they affected Kazan. I just spend a good deal more time, I think, than he did with, you know, kind of critical examinations of his plays and his movies. I mean, he doesn't do much of that. You know, he tells stories about the making of those films, but he doesn't really attempt to evaluate them or put them into historical perspective. And then the other thing is that, mysteriously, he had kept notebooks on almost every play and movie he ever directed. And those were sitting in an archive at Wesleyan, and I got permission to look at those from Kazan and from the archive, and that was just fabulous material in there because it's very unmediated. You know, he just sort of comes home from rehearsal and lets it rip, you know. And he's always looking for things in his life that analogize to things that are in the theatrical work he's doing. There's that kind of thing. There's just a lot of, you know, opinions, both shrewd and wacky in those notes. And so that added appreciably to the book, and that is material that's very personal to Kazan, but which he did not deploy in his autobiography. You know, I think people of the significance of Kazan deserve a formal outsider's perspective on their lives. I really do think that.
Well, I think a lot of people, based on what you have seen and what they already know, will want to read Ilya Kazan, a biography. Richard Schickel, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
That was Warren Olney with Richard Schickel, film critic for Time magazine. Today's program was produced by Sharon Rembaum with Karen Radziner and Francis Anterton. The technical director is John Patrick Costello. You can listen online anytime at moretothepoint.com. I'm Diana Nyad. Join us again for To the Point, produced live as a co-production of KCRW, Santa Monica, and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.
The video game industry is the fastest growing segment of the entertainment industry, with over 50% of Americans playing both over the internet and on home consoles. On To the Point, we'll take a look at the latest video games. Are they innovative or just another means to satisfy violent and addictive personalities? That's next time on To the Point from Public Radio International.
You've been listening to KCRW's To the Point. KCRW offers more than 20 podcasts, including Left, Right, and Center, our provocative, up-to-the-minute, witty confrontation over politics, policy, and popular culture, with Matt Miller, Robert Scheer, Tony Blankley, and Arianna Huffington. Check out the podcast of Left, Right, and Center at kcrw.com.